Qualify briefly. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting here at Central, the speaker meeting is 1 year continuous sobriety and attending a group conscience meeting and having Central as your home group. Well, I've got all three of those covered. So, again, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Maynard. I'm sure everybody's heard the word, the phrase, God works in mysterious ways. Well, it sure does, because the guy that's going to be sharing his story and I were running buddies in high school. So, yeah, Roger and I have a very thick history together. Our fathers were very good friends before we even met. So this goes way back. Like I said, Roger and I have been very good friends for a very long time. We were running buddies back in the day. I drank like a pig. Apparently he did too. But God saw it fit to have my happy little Irish ass end up in one of these beautiful white plastic chairs, and I'm so happy that Roger is too. That's enough out of me, our speaker, Roger.
Hey everybody, I'm Roger Lewis and I am an alcoholic. And it's good to be here tonight, sober. Well, let's see. I'll save you for last, I guess. But I was born on December 30th in 1954 in Daytona Beach. So I'm a native Floridian. And moved to Orlando in 1958, but my dad carpooled from Daytona to Orlando for about 4 years before we ended up moving. That December 30th, I hated that birth date because it sucked. The reason why it was so bad was Christmas, there was a problem with the presents, you see. And I never liked it. I actually resented it. And as we know, resentments are not good for alcoholics. And I, even as a small child, I used to, you know, just, why can't we just move my birthday to June 30th? No, wasn't going to happen. So I have an older brother that's 7 years older than me and one that's 7 years younger than me. So I was the middle child. And I was, in looking back, I was the one that caused my parents the most problems. My older brother was good, you know, straight-laced, did what he was supposed to do. My younger brother was too young to really get into any trouble. But I was the one. Even, you know, when I think back, I had a vivid imagination, so I was always thinking too much, even as a young kid. You know, just make believe, and why couldn't it be different? And if only, all those things, growing up, plagued me. And I remember the first time that I met a girl, I think I was probably about 10 years old. And, you know, I really had feelings for her, and she didn't, you know, want to have anything to do with me. And there was another resentment. And it was also something more, because it turned into fear. And you know, these were just little things that happened when I was growing up. And because I was thinking back about, you know, these are the things that shaped me. And before I found alcohol, I didn't really have any other way of coping with these feelings that I had. When I was a kid, I watched this on TV, the firewalkers that are in Bermuda. I'm not Bermuda, in the Bahamas. I guess there's some kind of a high priest or something that they're able to walk through fire. I don't know if you've ever seen that, or coals or what have you. And growing up in here in Orlando, we instead of having, you know, trash recycling, you used to be able to burn the trash in the backyard. And after watching those guys walk over those hot coals, I thought, you know, I bet you I can do that. So I did it. And I burned the living crap out of the bottom of my feet. You know, I never walked over fire again. And I have a great respect for fire today. But I can't tell you how many times drinking that I would just, my, the wheels would fall off. It was worse than the burn that I experienced that day walking on those hot coals. But yet I would do it again. And I don't know, I didn't understand that. First time that I had a drink, well, it was actually a couple of drinks, was my 8th grade graduation party. No, it wasn't my part, I was invited to one. And there was a girl there I liked, and there was one 6-pack of Pabst Blue Ribbon tall boys. And I got 2 of the tall boys. And I sure like that feeling that I got from drinking, being able to drink them. Yeah, because it was a full moon and it was on a lake. This party was great. And I don't think I ended up... Yeah, I don't remember really getting wasted. I got that feeling of ease and comfort that's talked about. And I liked it. And it was also kind of like a bragging thing too, you know, with all my friends that, hey, we had booze. And so that was part of it as well, you know, talking about it. But that was the first time, and that was the summer of 69. And then, as Jim alluded to, was high school. And you know, I really, when I look back, I wasn't really that nice of a guy. Because let me tell you what I did to Jim one time. Well, cut twice. I slammed his hand in the hood of a car. You know? And I mean, and that was supposed to be funny. And it wasn't funny. It hurt him. And you know, for that, I'm deeply sorry, and I made amends, but I just had to tell him myself, because, you know, doing stuff for a laugh wasn't funny. But the worst thing, I think, was the time when I took a jumper cable and clamped it to his butt. That was probably, because that the slamming his hand in the
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, that hurt.
Thank you. No wonder we turned off.
That's pretty much, that's pretty much what he said, too. I got to say that the slam in the hand was an honest mistake, you know, because I didn't know he had his hand in there, and I didn't do that on purpose, but we laughed about it, you know, our... But the battery jumper cable clamp, that was malicious, and that was mean. But that didn't stop us from doing stupid stuff together. But that was I had to let you know, you know, that's just malicious and mean, and not it ain't right. You're right. And for that I am deeply sorry. I am. So the first time that usually when I'd be drinking, I didn't get into, you know, or every time I got, the way it's been told to me was, you know, every time I got drunk, I didn't get in trouble, but every time I was in trouble, I was drunk. And the first time that happened, I was 15, and my friends and I decided that it was a good idea to lie and tell our parents that we're spending the night over at each other's friend's house, but we weren't going to be at that house. And so we took my friend's car, my friend's father's car, rolled it out of the driveway, sneaked it out, and decided to go night surfing over at New Smyrna. And as we were driving, we were in the car drinking and having a good time, and we decided that it would be smart, if we didn't go I-4, that we should drive 1792 and go the back way. And we ran a red light right in front of a cop, you know, because we were all watching the cop, not the red light. We didn't even see the red light. So, you know, it's pretty funny. We almost had the guy talked out, you know, talked out of letting us go, or talked into letting us go. But the sergeant showed up and he said, take them down to the station and have them call their parents. He knew, you know, I guess it was a rookie cop that stopped us at first, and we almost got away with it. At least we thought we did, you know, that's what we talked about. So, you know, it was a long ride home from the police station in my dad's car with him, because, you know, he was a good man, you know. I think, looking back, he would have been one of us, you know, but at the time, didn't really, you know, he was a good guy, he liked to drink. But when he picked me up in the car, he didn't say a word, and probably the worst thing I'd rather be yelled at, you know, because when I'm yelled at, I'm thinking, you know, kiss my ass, I don't care. But when there's silence, I don't like it. So there was a lot of silence, and then there was silence for about a month. Because, you know, it was like, you're not going anywhere, right? Okay. So that was at 15. And then, you know, high school started, and we were, you know, had that special group of guys that we hung out with that were the ones that always, you know, we partied. And, you know, we were that clique. And there was probably about 10 of us. And, you know, so we were always, you know, doing stuff that really was, like, you know, battery cables and slamming hands and just, you know, doing dumb things. But the next time that I was drinking and got arrested the next time, and I was 18. And interesting what had happened in the state of Florida when I was 17. They changed the law, the drinking law, from 21 down to 18 when I was 17. And that made it real easy to get alcohol when you're 17 years old, because they weren't really worried about carding. And I was about the same height that I am now when I was 17. And I wore my hair about as long as Jim's, and can't do that now. But so alcohol was always available, and it was always, you know, cheap stuff like Boone's Farm, apple, wine. God, the thought of that now makes me sick. And that Strawberry Hill, that, you know, that was the kind of the stuff that we would drink because it was cheap. And as a friend in the room says, there was also condiments involved as well. And that's all I'll say about that. But alcohol was always the starting point. And alcohol was always involved. So anyway, I'm thinking it's a good idea to drag race with a friend. And the Winter Park Police Department, they had this radar set up on our drag strip. So that was a stupid thing to do, you know, because I didn't exceed the speed limit. But the fact that I was over in the left-hand lane running next to him down the two-lane road, that was against the law. Because, you know, I thought, well, geez, we didn't go over 35 miles an hour. So, anyway, that was an arrest. And I complicated matters by running from the police, too. And because there was a six-pack of beer in the car, and that had to get rid of. I had to get rid of that. And when I threw it out of the car, I accidentally almost hit like a homeless guy. And he did not. He told the cop that I threw a gun out of the car. And so that kind of escalated everything way up. And, you know, I used to pride myself on being able to talk my way out of stuff, but there was no talking way out of nothing on that. So, once again, my dear old dad had to come down, and I had this vivid memory of my father. I had a little sports car, and the top was down, and I'm handcuffed in the back of the police car, and I'm looking at my dad in my car driving off with it pouring down rain, and he didn't know how to put the top up. Not good. And I think today, boy, you know, if my son would do that kind of crap to me, and I have to drive in the rain in a convertible without putting up the top. I no wonder my dad didn't talk to me very much, I guess. So that was the second time. Okay, so then I meet the woman that I'm going to marry, and it's funny, I had known her since fifth grade, okay, but I really didn't think much about her at that time. But anyway, I'm 21, and it seems like a good idea to settle down and get married. And at my wedding, of course, the whole bunch of guys that I ran with came, and there's this picture that I have that Coors beer had just been introduced into Florida at that time. And this would have been 74, I think. Yeah. And we got this neat pyramid of empty Coors cans that are stacked up on the table that's probably from almost the floor to the ceiling. And boy, you know, that was kind of the thing. You know, it's like, we're drinking, you know, and it's okay, and we're doing shots, and everything's fine. And that's the way I lived. And that's the way I only hang around with people like that. You know, because if you didn't drink like I did, there was something wrong with you, and that's the honest to God truth. I mean, if I had an opportunity to go to an event and there was no alcohol there, I didn't stay very long, or most of the time I didn't go. A wedding or, you know, a funeral or whatever, it was like, are you kidding me? No alcohol? What's wrong with you people? It's just the way I was, and so alcohol was, as I mentioned to you, it was very big. So my wife and I got married, and we had a son right away, and he was born premature, and he had cerebral palsy, and you know, I'm sorry, I got to back up a little bit. My dad that I told you about, he passed away about 2 years before I got married, and that was the first time that I can remember being super mad at God, to the point where we had buried my dad, and we came home, and my mom had said to my brothers and I, let's join hands, kind of like we do at the end of our AA meetings, and let's join hands and say in Our Father, and you know, for the repose of my dad's soul. And I remember the tears streaming down my face, cursing out loud, just saying unmentionable things that I will not repeat now, cursing God. And boy, I was madder than a wet hen, and I hated God at that point. So I had to back up there. So now fast forward 2 years, and my son is born. He has cerebral palsy. He's premature. He's in the ICU unit at Orlando Regional, and he was there for, God, 8 or 10 weeks. I can't recall now, but I was so pissed at God again, because how could you do this to me? You know, how could this... You know, my son. I wasn't even really thinking about him. I wasn't even really thinking before, when I was cursing God out when my dad died, about my mother who lost her mate, or my two brothers. You know, so I'm saying that because I wanted you to see how really self-absorbed and selfish, you know, all that was. So, my son, you know, I look back in the day before he was, since he was premature, I had been out the night before drinking, and I was drunk as hell. Came home, and when my wife went into labor, and I remember, you know, well, that's just kind of normal. I'll grab a cup of coffee and let's get to the hospital. You know, it was kind of like, that's normal. And it's insane is what it is. But and then my daughter is born 2 years later, and I'm at same she's when she was born, I was out the night before drunk. And you know, I remember being in the delivery room and just, you know, feeling like crap because I'm hungover. And you know, and that was another thing. I used to kid myself and think that, oh, no, I'm not hungover. I just don't feel quite right. You know, not being honest. Not being honest. So here I am, you know, just going through life, drinking. And, you know, I had a pretty good life because I was employed in a family business, and I was able to take advantage of a lot of situations and, you know, drink pretty much during the day when I wanted to, and, you know, eat a lot of breath mints, chew a lot of gum, try to just, you know, boy, you smell like alcohol. Oh, yeah, I had one. Yeah, I don't ever remember telling the truth about how much alcohol I ever consumed. The standard line was, yeah, I've had a couple. Well, what is a couple? Well, it's coupled to a couple, coupled to another couple, kind of like a train, you know how they have couplings? That's what a couple is. So so anyway, I'm going through life, and resentments are building up, and anger, and just, you know, trying to squelch it with alcohol and other things. And it's not working, and you know, I'm getting to the point where now my children have grown, they're put through college, and I'm thinking, oh man, I'm an empty nester, and life is going to be good. And so now my drinking is really escalating because I don't have any other responsibilities, I'm thinking, you know. So on March 28th of 2004, I get a DUI, and it is a result of me essentially abandoning my mother, who is terminally ill, living at my house, because my wife left for the weekend to go with some of her friends down to Miami, and I thought, hey, this is a good opportunity for me. Mom, I'll be right back. I leave at 11 a.m. in the morning on Saturday, and I got arrested Sunday morning at 3 a.m. See, what happened is my alcoholism took me to the point where when I start drinking, nothing else, you know, it's early. I just have a couple of more. You know, I'll get home, no problem. Cell phone going off. Oop, mute it. Don't answer the phone. And, you know, my mother, I just abandoned. So, anyway, I get arrested in Seminole County. So I don't go too far. I mean, I got Sanford and then Winter Park, Seminole County. I keep it pretty local, you know. But that's the third time now. And I'm 49 years old, and my life really isn't different than when I was 15 or when I was 18. And now I'm 49 and I'm still doing that kind of crap. I'm lying about what I'm doing, who I'm with, where I'm going, and what I'm drinking, how much I'm drinking. I'm lying. But I, That behavior is continually repeating itself over and over and over. And I can tell you, honestly, at the end of my drinking, there was that period of time where I'd come home drunk on Thursdays, because that was the night that I used to be able to get out with my buddies. You know, I had permission, and I would come home at 1 or 2 in the morning, drunk as hell, and I'd be laying in bed thinking, man, if I just wouldn't wake up tomorrow, everything would be great. My wife would get this insurance premium, and my life would be done. And I don't know why I was so miserable. I just felt it. It was just the way it was. And I get arrested, and I get thrown in the back of the police car, handcuffed. I was getting kind of, you know, I remembered what that was like from, you know, 20-something years earlier. But this time it was a little different, because the cop drove like a madman back to the jail, and I'm not even strapped in the back seat, flailing all over the place. And I'm thinking, God, would you freaking slow down? I'm going to get hurt. But you know, when you're really drunk, you kind of just bounce around. You don't really. You're not going. When you hit stuff, I was kind of mushy. So anyway, go to jail, and then all I'm thinking in the back of my mind, it's a good idea not to blow. It's a good idea to refuse the breath test. You know, that's what my buddy said. Man, if you get caught, just don't blow. So I said, I respectfully decline not to take a sobriety test. And then, I thought, oh, I'll be real polite to the cop. They don't care. You know, I'm stinking of alcohol. He followed me. He's got on video. I'm swerving and going over the line 3 times. And plus, it's, 3 a.m. Sunday morning. So the way it was explained to me, nothing much good happens after 11 o'clock at night anyway. You have no business being out there. And so I'm in jail, and my wife is out of town, and my poor mother can't drive because she's dying, literally has hospice coming to our house, and she's wondering where I am. So my daughter's 21 now, and I have to call her to get me out of jail. A 49-year-old dad has to call a 21-year-old daughter to get you out. And you know what my daughter tells me? Gee, Dad, don't worry. A lot of my friends had DUIs too. It's no big deal. You know what that makes a man, dad feel like? That's about the worst thing in the world that I needed to hear. Because I thought, oh, this is the example that I'm setting. Yeah, it's no big deal, Dad. Well, it is a big deal. Because I'll tell you how big of a deal it is. The big deal was that as a result of my DUI, it made me come to AA. And what happened was, for the first time, and I go to this meeting up in Altamont. It's called the Altamont Group. And I walk in there, court ordered, and they say, just like we do here, is there anybody new to AA? Just give us your first name. You know, it's not to embarrass you, just to get to know you. Hi, I'm Roger. You know. So, oh, well, we're glad you're here. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk about the first step tonight. Because that's what we do when people are new. So, there was about 15 people, small group, and they sat in a circle, and they all started telling a little piece of their story. And what I heard was, I felt that way. That happened to me. And, you know, whether it was a woman or a man, I felt at home that very first meeting. And, after the meeting, I picked up a white chip because I actually looked and listened, and I didn't identify I'm sorry, I didn't compare myself. I identified for about the first time ever. And they came up to me after the meeting and congratulated me and said, you know, buy a big book, get a sponsor, go to my 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. Because when I was in jail, I honestly thought, you know, I had that little voice within, you know, that we hear, that sometimes, well, that I hear, and I don't always listen to it, but that day in jail, I heard it say, man, you just can't drink anymore. You got to that point where you're done, you know, you're done. And so anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous helped me get to that point. Well, the judge actually did by making me go there. But so picking up that white chip, I asked a man that I never met before to sponsor me before I left the meeting that night. That's something that I would never done. I don't know why. Just so happens the guy had 10 years of sobriety. I really lucked out. And he said, oh, you know, here's the big book, or, you know, you have a big book. I want you to read the doctor's opinion. Give me a call tomorrow morning. We'll meet for coffee. And that's when we started working the steps. Because I actually think what happened to me in jail was the first step right there. Because I felt that powerlessness over alcohol, and definitely felt unmanageability as a result of riding in the back of this police car, not strapped in. I knew what unmanageability was. So we started working the steps, and you know, things didn't get better right away, because I'll tell you what, my wife was at the point where, you know, as a result of that episode, and she looked back at all the other episodes, and she was ready to leave, and you know, we had been married, I believe, at that time, would have been close to 27 years, and now she was just sick of it. Sick of all the bullshit that I was doing. So, anyway, things started changing. And it was kind of odd, because I was always, before that, wanting things to change on the outside around me. And as a result of working the steps, I started to make changes. My higher power started changing my heart. And that was really neat, because I needed changing. And then I started seeing miracles, because the 90 and 90 was very, very important for me, because that gave me a foundation. I started hanging with other people in recovery. I started going to a meeting regularly, and I made friends. So for me, it really worked. But ultimately, you know, I go back to that failure to do a breathalyzer, and that was going to suspend my license for a year, but some miracle happened as a result of some paperwork foul up, and I didn't get my license suspended for a year, and here I am, like 90 days sober, and I'm getting ready to walk into the meeting here. And I get a call from the attorney. He goes, I don't know how this happened, but they're not going to suspend your license for a year. So, you know, miracle. And because that's a big problem, get your license suspended. And so I start seeing these miracles happen. And then I just kept doing the deal. I just kept coming back. I didn't want to drink again. I saw people that went out and came back, and I never ever heard anybody say, yeah, it was good out there, but I'm coming back just because, you know, it's really good though. I never heard it. Never ever heard that. You know? When they come back, I can tell by the look on their face a lot of times that, yeah, I know that desperate, I know that gift, that desperate gift. And so anyway, then I got to the point where I'd completed the steps, and I was looking for something more, okay? And that's when my sponsor had me change groups. And I joined the Ponderosa group, and we meet, that's my home group, and we meet on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. It's a group that's been around for 16 years. It meets right over on Ivanhoe Boulevard, south 250 Southwest Ivanhoe Boulevard at the Orlando Christian Church. And you know what was different there was than the other group that I had attended for a couple of years was I got put into service right away with the group. And I got a position in the group. And that changed my sobriety because I wasn't always looking for something more because I had something to do. And they had... Now, I'm not just talking about, like, you know, making the coffee. I'm talking about, hey, we need a intergroup rep. You're going to have to go to the intergroup meeting every month on Sundays for 2 years. I'm like, oh, okay. And, you know, then you after that, you need to be a JSR. You got to go to the district meeting for 2 years. See, it's got all this 2 year stuff they do to you. And then after that, then it's become a DCM, district committee member. And that's a 2 year deal, too. So you get pressed into service. And it's different because your sobriety ends up blossoming. I don't know how else to describe it. It just grows because I don't know if you've ever felt that feeling like, God, is this all there is? You know? And there's something more just to, you know, I go to the meetings all the time, but I'm just not getting it. Well, you might want to try, if you're feeling that way, you might want to try a service position, you know, because then what happens is you got to get responsible. You can't just, well, I'll get to it tomorrow. Or, yeah, I'll get those meetings. I'll get to that next week. You know, you gotta really... your group's counting on you, and you got to do stuff. And you got to do it right. And you got to do it without complaint. And that's not real good for a guy like me, because I complain all the time about stuff. But I failed to mention that I have a sponsor, and he keeps me pretty good about complaints. Does a pretty good job. So anyway, I wanted to talk about that because, you know, I'm at 8 years. My sobriety date is 4/14/04, and you know, I remember them telling me, you know, you're at five. When I was at five, he said, oh, you're at that tough spot. You know, you better watch it. And, you know, I just didn't want to take a chance with my sobriety. I just didn't want it. Because I took all kinds of chances with my mom, my wife, my children. That drinking was always taking a chance with that. And now, today, earlier today, my daughter, we had my grandson's 1 year birthday today, and it was a blast. And you know, the reason why it was a blast is because I wasn't blasted. And that would have been a normal thing. I've been able to, with the help of God, you people, and AA, I've been able to go through both my children's weddings without having to worry about, God, I got a toast. How am I going to not drink? And sure. All that. I was able to do that, no problem. My mother, when she passed away, I was able to be there present. I was able to carry out all her wishes that she wanted done. She was kind of funny. She, you know, this was going to be said, and you're, you know, that we're going to read this, and this song is going to be sung, and all of that, da 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 da. It was all set up. That was the kind of lady she was. And we did it all without any problems. And so here I am rewarded, you know, with a mere 8 years of sobriety, and I'm at the point where I can't wait to see what else is in store for me, because I want to live today. I want to be happy with my sobriety today. And I'm not always that way, because I have to continually do the steps. And I find that, 6 and 7 are the ones that are helping to change me. And I found that as a result of the steps, something kind of neat happened. I read this. It's certainly nothing that I thought up. But it suggested that when you finished working the steps, that, and I think it's even referred to in the Big Book too, that about God being inside every one of us, or deep down inside, we have this notion that there is a God or a higher power. And maybe Alcoholics Anonymous, what it allows us to do is to let, if we have God within our hearts, maybe it lets us let God out, so that when we're with others, that we can show them kindness, tolerance, patience, love, understanding. So I'm kind of kicking that around today, thinking, yeah, maybe God's inside me and I'm supposed to let him out, you know. Before when I was drinking, I was God, you know. But so maybe that's it. I'll have to report back to y'all on that, because that's kind of new. But I see it work in others. I do. I see the ones that have something that I want. I also see people. That's the beauty of coming to meetings. You know, you see what you want and you see what you don't want. And that's okay, because you learn from it. And, if I was still drinking, I don't think I'd be learning anything, because my mind would be closed. I wouldn't, as it was told to me about, the acronym for HOW, honest, open-minded, and willing, I don't think I'd know how to stay sober. And it really is Alcoholics Anonymous. It had nothing to do with me. I just was able to get, kind of shoved in here. And just to doing something that I was told to do. But then, and like I said, I use that word blossom. It just has changed. So, if you're at a point in time in your life where you need change, maybe get a sponsor and try these steps, because it's very cost effective. It does not cost anything to do the steps. And if you're kind of cheap like I am, it works. It really does. I'm thinking I'm pretty much done, right? Because we're at 10 till. I don't know, unless anybody wants to ask me a question or two. What the hell? I don't care, I mean, why not? For a minute. I guess not. Okay. All right. Hey, I want to say thank you. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you tonight. It's kind of neat, because 7 years ago I was able to speak, and it was a lot different, because I only had a year's sobriety, and I remember coming up here with 8 sheets of paper all written out about my story, and it was mostly bullshit. But anyway, thanks for keeping me sober tonight.